right, my guest today is the founder of Global Resource Investments Limited and has been in the financial services business since 1974 with a particular investment emphasis upon mining, energy, water utilities, forest products, and agriculture. His name is Rick Rule. Rick, so great to have you on Follow the Money Weekly Radio.
A pleasure.
For those in our audience who may not be familiar with you, with your company, Global, why don't you tell them a little bit about yourself? Let's get started that way.
The main operation, Global Resource Investments, is a broker-dealer founded by myself in 1992. It has been since then focused on natural resource investments. Prior to that, I was in a variety of brokerage and financial services capacity, also focused, as you suggested in the introduction, really since the mid-70s in the natural resource-based businesses. Our investment approach is decidedly contrarian, meaning that we try and get into sectors that are deeply out of favor, anticipating a return to favor. And if we anticipate correctly and they return to favor, we begin to de-emphasize trades that we regard as crowded or popular and try and redeploy the money in unpopular sectors within the broad natural resource-based businesses.
Okay, Rick, I want to take a few minutes and run through some of the various natural resources that I'm sure you focus on with your clients. You obviously have a stated interest in and have had for many, many years, as you stated. I want to begin with silver. Silver obviously taking the limelight today. What are your thoughts on the silver markets right now and going forward?
Well, our chairman, Eric Sprott, is a well-regarded thought leader in the silver business. He has really been prescient in pointing out the move in silver that we've enjoyed over the last 12 months. From my own point of view, silver needs a rest. The chart sort of went hyperbolic, and in Canadian parlance, the backside of a hockey stick graph looks like the front of a hockey stick graph, but it's less fun. So I think in the near term, in the 4 to 6 week term, that you're going to see, at the very least, a breather and probably a retrenchment in silver bullion prices, and maybe a violent retrenchment in the price of the junior silver stocks. It's my own opinion that the bull market in silver isn't broken, but that we will see a pretty substantial backing and filling. Some of your older listeners, literally as opposed to figuratively, some of your older listeners will remember back in the 1970s bull market in gold, when gold ran from $35 an ounce to a high of $850 an ounce. In 1975, there was a hiatus in that gold bull market that saw the gold price fall from about $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce. So fairly severe retrenchments can take place in bull markets that don't really interrupt the bull markets, but they scare the participants pretty significantly. And I think we're into one of these retrenchments right now.
What are your thoughts on silver mining stocks as opposed to the actual bullion itself? What is a silver mining stock, or what type of investor would a silver mining stock be better for versus physical bullion?
The silver bug to begin with is like the gold bug on steroids, which means that what silver is really good for is volatility. Investors that have nerves of steel and patience can do extraordinarily well trading silver, and even better trading silver stocks. But people who decide to trade silver stocks have to have the sort of gut for 30 or 35% volatility. They have to be true contrarians, willing to buy into panics and sell into elation. The other thing with regards to the silver stocks is that there's a real distinct shortage of them. And there is a shortage of competent management in the silver business, which means that if there are 60 or 70 equities available that have silver in the title, probably only 10% of them have any validity as good speculations. And so the silver speculator must be willing to, A, have courage and nerve, but also, B, have patience and be willing to study. If those two criterion are met, this is an unbelievably fertile terrain for a speculator. You know, the silver stocks business over the last 20 years have been enormously kind to me. I organized the first private placement financing in Pan American Silver back in 1991 at 50 cents a share. And, you know, at plus $40, you can imagine how happy the customers are as a consequence of that. And similarly, we organized the first private placement financing in silver standard at 72 cents. It's been a sector that's been enormously rewarding for me. But in some senses, Jerry, I feel like I've deserved it as a consequence of having been patient and having endured an awful lot of volatility between then and now. And I would caution readers that despite the enjoyment that everybody's had in the silver market over the last quarter, on a going forward basis, you better fasten your seatbelts. If you have the guts for that kind of thing, it's a superb arena.
That's good advice. Okay, let's move over to the gold markets. What are your thoughts about gold going forward?
I own a reasonable amount of bullion personally, and I own it not out of greed because I think it's going to go up, but rather out of fear. Gold has been catastrophe insurance for most of the recorded history of mankind, and I don't want to be such a gloom and doomer that I say the world's going to come to an end, but it wouldn't surprise me if the social circumstance and the economic circumstance of the developed nations gets worse or a lot worse over the next 5 or 6 years. And historically, bullion has been the right sort of place to be in those sets of circumstances. So I'm in the odd position of owning a fair bit of bullion and hoping that the price falls. I own gold stocks for other reasons. I own gold stocks because I see internal improvements in the company, in the case of bigger gold companies, or I see the possibility or probability of exploration success in the smaller companies. And I note that for the first time in 3 or 4 years, the price of gold stocks is lower than the net present value of their estimated free cash flows at current gold prices, which means if the gold price holds, it would appear that some of the bigger gold stocks are very good values at today's gold price. This hasn't been true over the last 2 or 3 years, where the price of the gold stocks has risen fast enough to anticipate the increase in the price of gold. So I would say that listeners of yours who are A, speculatively inclined, and B, who believe that the price of gold is intact and going higher, needs to begin, at least with their speculative portfolios, favoring the gold stocks rather than the bullion.
You know, as we move into the remainder of this year and as we head into 2012, it just seems like we're going to have, as we've already seen just very recently, an influx of new precious metals investors who have no clue how to buy it. They really have no type of understanding of how the precious metals markets work. They just simply see silver and gold going up in price. And so as we look forward to a long-term bull market in precious metals, I was wondering if you could provide some sort of rule of thumb for those individual investors to know when it's best to take some profits off of the table or when it's best to stay long, especially when we see some of the recent corrections or maybe just the mild corrections that we're seeing today.
If 35 years in resources has taught me anything, it's that these businesses are both cyclical and volatile. And I have a rule of thumb for new investors, as you suggest, that they need to remember. In these businesses, you are either a contrarian or you are a victim. There's no middle ground. When you see downside panic in the metals, absolutely capitulation selling, when the charts resemble the trajectory of a brick thrown off a bridge, that's the time you have to buy. When you're feeling like a genius because the things that you bought up are going up at a very, very, very rapid clip, that's the time to take a breath and sell. It's really, truly counterintuitive, but that's the way you have to play these games. When the markets are in melt-up, you have to have the foresight to sell. And when the markets are in meltdown, you have to have the courage to buy. It's easy to say, it's tough to do. Even after 35 years, I don't always get it right.
Let's move over to the energy sector for a moment. You and I are both believers in the uranium story. Share with our audience why you believe that uranium will outperform, and do you prefer direct exposure to uranium through, say, a futures-oriented ETF, or do you prefer uranium mining stocks?
Because I have relatively deep knowledge myself and I can compete in the equities markets, I personally prefer the uranium stocks. Having said that, I am a direct and indirect participant in Uranium Participation Corp, which is, of course, sponsored by my parent company, Sprott Inc., and I'm also a direct shareholder in it. Looking in a broader sense, I, like yourself, am a bull on all forms of energy. I think that people will be surprised by uranium prices, oil prices, gas prices, and electricity prices 5 years from now. I think they'll be ecstatic as investors, and I think they'll be apoplectic as consumers. I think that people who don't have adequate levels of energy investments in their portfolios, adequate at least enough to hedge their own personal consumption, are making a very serious mistake.
Rick, at the end of the summer of 2010, I was noticing the technical charts of Japan's broad equity markets began to signal an upward momentum of sorts. And so I began to actually want to move into Japan and actually begin to buy. And then, of course, the Japanese markets were hit hard by the March earthquake, the tsunami, the nuclear disaster. And they really haven't regained their previous 2011 highs over in Japan. So I'm curious on your general thoughts on Japan, whether you think or believe that it may be a good place for investors over the next several years.
I think that's a very interesting idea, and I'm of two minds with regards to Japan. What I like about Japan is the incredible ethos of savings in Japan and the extraordinarily low levels of enterprise value to EBITDA, meaning that the businesses are very cheap on a fundamental basis. What I'm nervous about Japan is the extraordinary level of public debt, the opaque nature of the political process, and the extraordinary amount of capital that they have to divert from productive uses to unproductive uses as a consequence of the earthquake and the tsunami. I guess in terms of myself, I regard all of this with academic interest, because I personally don't invest in businesses that I don't understand particularly well, which means that my own investment outlook is sort of limited to the natural resource-based businesses, and the number of natural resource-based issuers in Japan is extremely small. In the context of Japan, I think it has given us an interesting entree into the uranium business, because one of the circumstances that arises from the earthquake and the ongoing problems in Japan has been that uranium stocks were down 25 or 30% as a consequence of the events in Japan. And I think the events in Japan, if you term them that, the events surrounding the reactors are not finished. I would suspect that we will get ongoing scares in the uranium business that will provide us ongoing opportunities to pick up uranium producers or near production companies on a discounted basis as a consequence of people's somewhat irrational fears with regards to Japan.
What kind of opportunity do you believe that uranium presents to an investor versus something like natural gas or some other alternative energy source?
Well, I'll tell you, I like the natural gas business, and I like the economic alternative energies like geothermal extremely well. I just think that what's interesting about uranium is that people have fears about it that are inconsistent with the engineering realities of the nuclear power business. Listen, we might want to live in a world where we don't have to risk the externalities associated with generating electricity from uranium, but we can't. Neither can the Japanese. The truth is that 19% of the electricity that we enjoy in the United States comes from nuclear power plants, and our choice is very simple. We can continue to use nuclear energy, or we can turn the lights out. Those are our choices. Even in Japan, which is, of course, the epicenter of the recent events, they have no choice but to use uranium. Uranium is the densest fuel on the planet, which means that an island nation with no resources of their own, call it Hong Kong, call it Taiwan, call it Japan, can store enough energy in the form of uranium that they can be, at least for a while, energy self-sufficient in any geopolitical environment. If you compare that with oil or coal or natural gas, the energy density of uranium, that is the amount of energy that you get out of a cubic meter of fuel, is absolutely unparalleled. So I would suspect that after a period where people react viscerally against uranium and make decisions based on their feelings, even in a nation like Japan that has been immediately impacted with this, they will have no choice but to continue to use uranium. One of the things that points to this is that while our opinion of the uranium markets are geared by the uranium spot market, which has fallen from about 75 to about 55, only 12 to 15% of worldwide uranium trade takes place on the spot market. The long-term market, that is the contract market in uranium, is still trading at about $80 a pound, which would suggest that there has been absolutely no impact whatsoever in terms of the industry's pricing forecasts on a going forward basis with regards to uranium. I think there's a big difference in perception between the speculative community and the utility community. And I would suspect in this case that it's the utility community that understands the uranium market much better than the speculative community.
Rick, I was the same way watching the events in Japan and, of course, watching the price of uranium and many of the top producers. And to me, it seems as if we have another window of opportunity here, maybe 3 or 4 or 5, maybe 6 months before things really begin to return to some sense of normalcy again. How long do you think that window exists of opportunity for investors to get into uranium?
I suspect you're right. What I've asked my clients to do is to take a sort of a 30, 40, 50% position now and be prepared to pay up 25% or down 25% in 6 months. You know, you can't tell how the events in Japan with regards to containing those reactors is going to play out. All you can do is operate within a realm, a realm of probabilities. And so I would say that sometimes things are cheap enough, and I think the better uranium stocks are cheap enough now, which isn't to say that they couldn't get markedly cheaper going forward, but no one can tell for sure. So take part of a position now, take part of a position in 3 to 6 months.
Okay, news on food inflation, tightening supplies recently have turned many investors to the idea of investing their money in agricultural commodities. What areas do you personally like in this sector? And again, do you prefer futures contracts, ETFs, or equities for gaining exposure to agriculture?
The answer is yes, yes, and yes. I think that agricultural commodities are in a real sustained bull market. I mean, when I was born 58 years ago, food made up more than 30% of the average household budget in the United States. Food now makes up about 14% of the average household budget in the United States. With more value added to the food that we buy. What that means is that food isn't cheap. It's felony cheap. Very, very, very cheap. At the same time that the price has fallen, demand for food is increasing, and paradoxically, supplies are declining. This is the stuff of a first-rate bull market. As people get richer and richer around the world, that is, poor people get richer and richer around the world, they want their caloric density to increase. They want to eat grains, but in the form of beef, and they want to eat higher quality grains. The demand for agricultural commodities on a worldwide basis is increasing at a much more rapid clip than the population is increasing. At the same time that the supplies of first quality arable land is declining. And one of the things that your listeners might not think about in the context of food exports is that food exports are in some senses water exports and also energy exports. When, you know, if you think about how much water it takes to produce a kilo of gram or a kilo of beef, it's a truly staggering amount. And the other thing that people need to consider, at least in terms of the grains, is that as a consequence of the Green Revolution, the amount of nitrogen, which is, of course, stripped out of natural gas, contained in a kilo of grain is very, very, very high. So while energy prices rise, while water prices rise on a sustainable basis around the world, you need to look for the prices of agricultural commodities to rise. And in terms of playing it, you can play it in the futures markets if you want. You can play it in the context of the ETFs or equities of food producers. And you can also play it, and I think this is a very valid play, in the shares of the nutrient producers, the fertilizer producers on a worldwide basis. I think we're in a really sustained bull market across the board in soft commodities and foods.
Rick, one of the trends also that you believe and I believe as well that is coming down the pike is the decreasing global access to pure water. We bring up food, and of course you brought up the case of water. What does your research tell you about the future of clean global water supplies, and what are some of the ways in which investors can participate in this sector?
Boy, that's absolutely terrifying. They've set out here in the West and the Southwest. I think it was Mark Twain that said that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. And I think that's a prelude, in fact. To invest in water, you have to understand that water isn't a global market. It's a series of local markets. And the attribute that you look for in a local market is, in the first instance, water must be short. In Canada, the water market is characterized by how to make the water go away. So you need to be in a place like California or Texas or Arizona where water is scarce. In the second instance, in addition to it being scarce, people have to afford it, have to be able to afford it. So as an example, a source of water in Eritrea or Ethiopia isn't worth much because although they need it, they can't afford to pay for it. In the third instance, water is highly politicized worldwide, and you don't merely get to look at supply and demand. If you did, water investments would be a function of what we call free market physics, where water flows uphill to money. But instead, water is politically allocated, meaning that it flows downhill to votes. So you need to look at those three sets of circumstances. What you learn in that context, especially if you are an American investor, and more particularly if you live in the U.S. West and Southwest, is that companies that own water rights rather than distribute water are probably the plays. And those companies are few and far between. Normally, what you have to do to get access to water rights in the United States is buy companies that are primarily engaged in agriculture and, in fact, own their water rights as a consequence of, 75 or 80 years exposure to buying water rights or buying land containing water for the purposes of farming.
Yeah, this seems like a sector that's a little difficult for the individual average investor to get access to, especially considering the monumental shift we're going to see as, the population increases and the clean potable water becomes more difficult to get. Are there any ETFs that are out there on this level that would be worthy of looking at?
Only ETF that I'm familiar with is WTR, which isn't one that I know how to analyze, because out of the 150 some odd stocks that are in it, almost all of them are involved in water process and filtration, which, while I suspect it's a good business, is an area that I don't know enough to comment on. Mercifully for myself, because I've been investing in agricultural stocks for 25 years, I have a relatively deep knowledge of the water rights associated with many farming companies. It's a sector that I've had to myself because both water and ag have bored American investors for 25 years, so I've been able to acquire more knowledge than other people simply because other people haven't looked at it. And that's a function of the things we talked about at the beginning of the broadcast, where I said, you're either a contrarian or you're a victim. You have to pay attention to markets when nobody else cares about them. I'm highly confident that sometime in the next 5 years, you'll see water on the cover of Business Week magazine and Time magazine. And that will, of course, be the time to sell, because water is such a vital commodity that the arbitrage that exists in water between its price today and the price that it'll sell for 5 years from now would be a very tempting target for either the federal government or the state government to steal.
Mm. Well, we are in our remaining moments with our guest, Rick Rule. Rick, one final question. I really want to get your thoughts as a natural resource investor on the topic of the U.S. financial markets as we head into the end of QE2. There's a lot of speculation that the QE2 is going to morph into a QE3. Obviously, there could be a span of time between the QE2 and the QE3, or we may not see anything at all, though it's highly unlikely considering the fact that we really don't have no one to borrow money from besides the Fed right now. But I would be very interested in hearing what's your take on that, specifically when it comes to those who are holding natural resources, which have benefited so greatly from a decreasing dollar. How does the Fed, the QE2, QE3, how does all this factor in your mind in regard to natural resources?
Well, I thought I'd get through the whole interview being positive. I think we're in a lot of trouble. I look back to the set of circumstances that I believe caused the 2007-2008 liquidity crisis, and I don't see how any of the sets of circumstances that caused that crisis have been cured. I see a situation where, from my point of view, the big banks and the government kicked the can down the road, And I figure we're a lot closer to the can now. So I see probably the probability as opposed to the possibility of renewed weakness on the order of magnitude that we saw in 2008. I think in the very near term, there's a lot of confidence in financial markets. And I would note that you could argue that the root word in confidence is con. And I think that the con has been pretty successful, but I don't think it's altered the truth. Specifically, I think that Bernanke will try and lead people to perceive that he is moving away from quantitative easing. I don't think he's actually been involved in quantitative easing in the fashion he says. The suggestion is that they're pumping money into the economy to reflate asset prices. I think the reason that the Fed has been buying federal obligations is simply because they haven't been able to sell them to anyone else. I think quantitative easing is a very long way to say counterfeiting. And I think the fact that the U.S. government has been debasing or counterfeiting the U.S. currency will exacerbate the liquidity shortages that we ultimately feel. When the notion of con overcomes the confidence that's been associated with the incredible increase of money supplies in U.S. financial markets. And I think the consequence of that, before it's really felt by way of a liquidity shortage, will be in extreme volatility, which is what I think will be the hallmarks of the equities markets, including the natural resource markets, in the next 6 months. I think in terms of the ultimate impact on resource markets, certainly hardcore inflation, which is the inevitable result of the debasement of the money supply, will increase the nominal prices for natural resources simply as a consequence of the fact that they're denominated in U.S. dollars. And when the denominator falls, the numerator can do what it wants, and prices still feel like they're going up. I think longer term, of course, that we're going to have a real price appreciation in natural resources as well. But the amount of volatility that a speculator will have to endure for the balance of this year will, I think, test many of them so much that they don't have the courage to continue with the market, which I think will be tragic for them.
Very interesting. My guest today has been Rick Rule. Rick, for those in our audience who may be interested in contacting you, learning more about you and your company, how can they do so?
Two ways: on the web at www.gril.net, or by phone at 800-477-7853.
Rick, I really appreciate you coming on Follow the Money Weekly Radio. You're a wealth of information, and I really appreciate all of your time today.
True pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.